Today on The Grave Talks, the Charleston Dungeon. It's housed prisoners of war. It's been the final resting place to hardened criminals. It has also been a place where political foes, for some, went to disappear. The Charleston Dungeon has one of the most horrific and intriguing stories of any structure still standing in historic Charleston. Today, the structure stands as a museum and a testament to a much darker time in our history. A time when pirates came off the sea, would frequent the town and its people. A time when lawlessness was a way of life. The big question is, do the spirits of that time still stand face to face with the living of those who visit the Charleston Dungeon today? Today, we talk with paranormal investigator Randy Johnson about the Charleston Dungeon.
The dungeon is probably the building in the city that has the richest history of all, because when the settlers arrived on ships, and we can imagine their faces being terrified because they arrived here in this wilderness not knowing what they were facing, the first instinct they had was to build a wall. And the wall ran down East Bay Street in the old city, up to Trad, cut up Trad going west, and then cut up Meeting Street going north, and then cut back somewhere around the city market. And it encompassed a very narrow city pushed up against the river, the Cooper River. And on that wall, literally on it, they built what they called a court of guard, which was a constabulary or a guard station, where they kept several soldiers. And underneath it, on the very bottom level, they created a place to shackle people, to hold them until they could either be whipped and released or hanged. And that became known as the dungeon. And that's the main section underneath the exchange building. And then later, in the 1770s, when the city was still part of the British Empire, the citizens of the city and the British authorities decided to tear down the old quarter guard and build a much more imposing edifice called the exchange building. But underneath, they left the dungeon. And so the dungeon goes back to the 1680s, and the newer building on top of it, newer, you know, relatively, goes back to the 1770s. It's a much more stately building. It's very imposing. You could see it from the harbor as you enter from the Atlantic Ocean. And it stood right on the wall where the dungeon was, and literally was built on top of it. So when you walk in the dungeon, the first thing that hits you is that you're on top of you, you see this beautiful vaulted ceiling made with a very elaborate brick bond. And that creates the ceiling of the dungeon now. And it's formidable. I mean, you walk in there and it's very intimidating because you feel oppressed, you feel pushed down. And that's where they continued to shackle people before they would whip them or hang them. Until they finally built another jail in the city called the Old City Jail, which still stands as well, around 1802. But because of its timing, the dungeon is a place where Charlestonians shackled pirates like Stede Bonnet before they were hanged down at the Battery. And it's also the place where later, during the British occupation of Charleston during the Revolutionary War, this is where the British threw all of the, what they call traitors, the people who had supported the revolution. And so, in addition to a place where pirate ghosts haunt, we get a lot of Revolutionary War ghosts, including the ghost of Isaac Haynes, someone that all children read about in history books, a big hero during the revolution. So, it's, you know, it's just rich with history.
Obviously, they were aware that the dungeon was there when they put the exchange building on top of it. Why did they want to keep the dungeon at that point?
Even in 1772, there wasn't much to the city. it wasn't a big city, and that was prime real estate. And it already had a very solid brick floor. It already had, the shackles, the loops popping up out of the walls that were used to, secure the prisoners to the walls. And I think it was just a matter of being efficient and expedient, Why tear it down? Why tear that part down?
Mm-hmm.
Why not keep it? Use it? So it was just a matter of being, I think, efficient.
What would someone have to do to end up in the dungeon? Obviously, we have some of the more famous names that have been through there, but just the more typical, less noteworthy individual, what would you have to do to end up in there?
You would probably have to steal. But it would be more than just a casual, flipping an apple off of a table at the market, and throwing it in your pocket. That probably wasn't enough to wind you in the dungeon. But if you committed any kind of serious theft, if you trespassed, you committed burglary, back then, during the time it was a colony of Great Britain, everything was covered by British law, and the other concept they would have held back then was this idea of the king's peace. The king's peace. If you breached the king's peace, if you disturbed the king's peace, if you were disruptive in the streets, even, or if you committed libel, if you slandered somebody, they could probably, or slandered the king, they could throw you in there. There was, a different concept of justice, because it had no grounding in a constitution. It was all based on British law.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty arbitrary, And another thing about British law during that period of its history was what we had. There was a lot of arbitrariness to it, And it was very much aimed at the poor. So if you were wealthy, you would probably never wind up in the dungeon, even if you committed a heinous crime. But if you were poor and had no resources, probably even a small, simple crime, you could easily wind up in the dungeon and die because no one cared. And so there was a lot less respect for human rights. Because, again, you're not protected. That's why we have the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So, there were a lot of people in the dungeon who didn't belong there from our point of view. But from a British point of view back then, it was consistent with their idea of justice, because their whole point was to just impose authoritarian rule on a colonial people without any concern for their rights or their interests or any kind of fairness. And that's kind of how I see it. It was a place where you would have wound up even if you just said the wrong words to a particular British official. You could easily wind up in the dungeon. That's always how I've imagined it. It's just right out of a movie.
Yeah. How long was the dungeon used? Up until what point in history was it functioning as this prison, if you will?
Off and on, I'd say until around 1802.
Okay. Now, obviously, it is still there today, and there's a large chunk of history where it was not used as the dungeon. What was its life after 1802 up until, more modern day, where we got more curious about its history, and it was just there? What was going on with the dungeon and that space?
It's not pretty. In fact, I would say it's even more dark than the period when it was actually used in the jail, because after 1802, Charleston had a formal jail. It's a four-story jail with large holding cells and torture rooms in the bottom. It was a full-service jail. But after 1802, what happened was the Exchange Building was called the Exchange because that's where Charlestonians went to do business. So in the upper floors of the exchange, and again, it's a very stately, beautiful building. That's where Charlestonians entertained dignitaries. George Washington was entertained in the exchange building. There's a great hall on the top floor. And during his visit to Charleston in 1791, the city officials threw this big whirligig for him. And there were fireworks that were shot from barges out in the harbor. And he and his cohorts would have stood in the windows on the top floor of the exchange to watch this whole fanfare unfold. But it was also a place where Charlestonians, and we're talking about the top part, and then I'll get down to the bottom. And the top part, that was from the steps of the exchange building, is where Charlestonians first heard the Declaration of Independence being read publicly. It's also the first place where Charlestonians heard the Constitution being read out loud. And it was inside the exchange building that a legislative body ratified the U.S. Constitution to create the country. So, I mean, it's a stately building, but underneath what happened after the Revolution and definitely after the official jail was constructed in 1802 was it just became a place where they stored things. I mean, they even used it occasionally for storing things before that. Charleston had a tea party, you know, right before the Revolution, and the tea that was seized wound up being stored underneath there, and a mob formed later and took it and used that tea to sell and raise money to support the war effort during the Revolution. So, you know, it saw different intermittent uses, but after 1802, when the jail was built, the dungeon became either a place where things were stored or a place where people were stored. But when I say that, and I want to be very, very sensitive here, we're talking about enslaved people, because after the Revolution and certainly after the jail was built, it became a place where enslaved people were held until they were brought out to an auction table, which used to stand on the north side of the building. And the elite Charlestonians would gather in crowds and bid on the enslaved people as they were brought out. Very unpleasant part of American history, but it's unfortunately it's what happened, and it's something I always deal with when I when I give historical tours, or even sometimes when I give ghost tours, because there are always ghosts there of slaves. We know slaves died in there under horrible conditions, and I like to celebrate their courage and their ability to make it through such horrible things. And yet I can't talk about them in any kind of specific way, because unfortunately during that time people didn't write about them, and they certainly weren't allowed to write about themselves, and most of them probably were illiterate and deliberately kept that way. So it's a gap in our history, and yet I like to at least allude to it just to give acknowledgement to these poor people who suffered so horribly. But so it was used for that, and then it was also used, again, like I said, I'm sure there were offices at times down there. There probably would have been U.S. custom officials and working down there. But certainly by the end of the Civil War, it wasn't used for much because the city was in decline, had been bombarded. And so after the Civil War, after the era of slavery, the building, including the bottom floor, fell into horrible disrepair. And what's really fascinating is that during that time, and nobody knows much about it because no one was writing about that either. They were just trying to survive after the Civil War. Of course, the Union used the upper floors as often. Union officials would have used some of those rooms to administer the occupation force control during Reconstruction. But you know, eventually that ended, and when the Union troops withdrew, the custom building, the exchange building, just fell into disrepair. And it wasn't until the 1960s that people started talking about what they were going to do with it. It literally sat there, pretty much empty, that period. They did use it as a post office. I know it was the U.S. post office for a time. And it was used intermittently as a post office even before the Civil War broke out. And then, and you know, we're talking about a building that's been around since the 1680s, so we've got this rich history. Things come in and come out, It goes back to old uses, and they use it for something else. But by the 1960s, it was clear from my own recollections as a person, I'm not young, I'm not that old, but I remember in the 1960s, the Daughters of the American Revolution finally purchased the building from the city of Charleston because it was slated for demolition. And a bunch of people were in arms. We can't let this happen. This is a very significant building. And God bless them, they stepped in and bought the building, saved it from demolition, and then really didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know what it was, really. They didn't know what they had. They just knew it was extremely valuable. And so they sent archaeologists down into the bottom floor with a dungeon in. And they couldn't get down there because over the years, after the Civil War, there had been so many hurricanes and flood tides. And remember, it's right on the water. It's not far. And later, there was a little landfill behind it. But it's close to the water. It's close to the Cooper River. It used to be on the river. During that time, it would flood. And silt would come in. And so when you walk into the dungeon today, from the back, the first thing you notice is a set of free-flying stairs that just end in midair. And those were left there by the Daughters of the American Revolution to remind everybody that that's where the silt had accumulated. So literally, back then, if you had tried to crawl down in a dungeon, say in the 1960s, you would have had to have gotten on your hands and knees and crawled because there wasn't enough room to stand up from all the silt. But they dug all that stuff out, and lo and behold, during that excavation, they found a piece of the original defensive wall that I talked about at the beginning of the talk. They were shocked. They had no idea the old defensive wall was under there. They thought the wall had to have been buried somewhere else. They didn't know that they had built the exchange building on top of it. And so they excavated down along the wall, dug everything out, revealed the original flooring, which was all brick, and opened it up, aired it out, and then turned it into a museum. And that's what it is today.
When was the first reports of anything paranormal going on connected with that building, with the exchange building, with the dungeons? How far back does that go where people are saying there's something odd here?
I think it was probably right after the Civil War.
Okay.
There are a few offhand references by folks writing about the city, some of them by visitors. And they would say, they would just comment that at night when they would walk by that building, it would give them a creepy feeling. And the first report of any kind of paranormal activity in the dungeon probably comes from that period, probably in the 1880s, 1890s, where people said that as they would walk by from the bottom level where the dungeon is, they would hear moaning. Moaning has always been this constant theme about the dungeon, the moaning. And what they're talking about is probably a cumulative effect of suffering. And what happened with the dungeon was this. When they built it, somewhere around 1681, 1682, as soon as they arrived here, they built it right on the ground. I mean, it was like literally at zero sea level. And when they built it, the city continued to build up itself. And around, over the centuries, what happened was the dungeon, which had been at street level, wound up becoming more of a basement. Now, Charleston cannot have basements. Our water table is so high that if we tried to build basements, they would simply flood. But this building, when you walk into the dungeon, you immediately feel like you're in a basement because the street has literally risen about 5 feet around you from debris, trash, junk, tree leaves, you name it. Over the centuries, it's just fallen on the ground around the dungeon and built up. So that when you look at the dungeon, one of the first things you notice is on the bottom level, there are a set of barred windows that go all the way around it, front and back, and on the sides, these barred windows. And of course, people always rush up there to look inside. And that's where the moaning comes from. People hear the moaning coming up from the depth, down they're deep down in the dungeon, and they hear the moans coming up through those barred windows. And there are many accounts in the early colonial years, of folks running up to those windows and either trying to talk to their loved ones who were incarcerated inside, shackled to the walls, or taunting them if they were considered enemies of the city. You know, they would taunt them. And so this moaning thing, if you go back and read early references to the dungeon, you'll hear people talking about the moaning. And most people assume that it was the pirates, that it's the moaning of pirates. And people calling for water, 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 because they would leave them shackled to the walls and they would neglect them. And since you're shackled to a wall, even if there was a water bucket near you, you couldn't reach it. And so you had to have a system. People had to scoop it up in a scooper and hand you water. And I'm not going to try to cast aspersions on a bunch of jailers, but I doubt very seriously they were very nice people. So, you know, if they were in a bad mood or they were distracted, you know, people would suffer from dehydration. And it was a horrible place. Over the centuries, you know, not just in the early years, but throughout its history, the jail, a place where they'd lock you up or lock you to the, you know, shackle you to the wall, people died in chains. People died from natural causes. They died from, you know, dehydration, from lack of nutrition. They died from typhus. They died from, you know, any kind of disease carried by rats, because there were rats everywhere down there. And in Charleston, our rats are so big, we don't call them rats. We call them river dogs. And they're very aggressive. And people would have been attacked by the rats because they're weak, open wounds. There were, you know, palmetto bugs, these giant cockroaches that fly, all these different things that carry horrible diseases. And also, as I mentioned, you know, over the centuries, the dungeon was filled with silt because of the flooding. Well, sometimes it would flood when there were prisoners in there, and they would drown, and they would scream and cry out for help, you know, please let me go, release me, release me. So there's this idea of plaintive calls, you know, people begging for help, coming up from the windows on the ground level of the dungeon from the outside.
In more modern times here, when it was the exchange building above it and it was functioning as office space and various business aspects, what were some of those accounts of paranormal activity that would be attributed to this otherwise unexpected basement of the building?
Lots and lots of footsteps. And every now and then people would say that they would turn a corner down in the dungeon, and it was as if they had been transported back in time. And visually nothing would change. They would still be standing, let's say, in 20th century dungeon, looking around, you know, even at exhibits, you know, and mannequins that were put up for illustrations and exhibitions. And they would hear, it would be as if they had been transported back in time, and they could hear people screaming at each other. They could hear guards yelling. They could hear the clank of the shackles against the walls. People struggled with them, and people moaning and screaming. And you could hear it. It's a phenomenon that you see in other haunted buildings, but it's very prevalent in the dungeon, almost as if it were a vortex, like different time dimensions were rubbing up against each other, you know, with a lot of tension. And every now and then something cracks through. And if you're standing there when that happens, you can hear the world in the past kind of swarming around you. And it doesn't last long. It lasts like 10 or 15 seconds, and then it's gone. But it can be terrifying. It's very disoriented. It's happened to me. Not at the dungeon. It's happened at the old city jail. But I've talked to people who've experienced it at the dungeon. It's almost like a transportation.
Yeah. When you're at, when they began the transformation of the building and the dungeon into a museum, how did that go? You know, I would imagine that things might have been stirred up a little bit. So I'll just leave it at that. How did that go?
Well, there's all this untold story in Charleston about the poor workers who were sent in to do all this stuff. You know, first impression. We don't have any written accounts, but I'm sure the first people who went down there definitely got the creeps, because they could sense all this stuff around them, and it's crawling with ghosts. I mean, I've seen video people have taken on my tours And you can see spirits literally coming out of the walls. And I mean, full body apparitions, you know, like tall men crawling out of the walls. And I'm sure that went on in the beginning. And these people were probably hugely apprehensive. And, you know, tools flying, because ghosts don't like it when you show up in a space after a long period of peace and silence. They get really agitated. And so there would have been a lot of that. But I think the first thing that really surfaced, kind of stuck around all these years, that you'll hear a lot of guides referencing, is that when they set it up as a museum, people argue about how cheesy or appropriate it is to have these mannequins in there. But the mannequins definitely add a creep level. And I've had so many people come up to me and tell me that they swear they saw mannequins move. And I don't think they're seeing the mannequins move. And I'm talking about mannequins dressed in period clothing, like colonial era or pirate era clothing. And they're creepy in their own right. But what happens is people claim that they see them move or they hear them talk. This is impossible. But imagine you're one of those workers installing these mannequins for the first time and putting chains up to designate the exhibition areas where you don't want people walking and touching the mannequins. People, workers, and now people since then all say they see the chains move and rattle. And these are big, like, separator chains that separate the exhibit areas from the areas where visitors walk. They move all the time, and there's no explanation for it. There's, again, it's like some kind of weird vortex. So these chains move. You know, it's almost as if the spirits inside don't like the chains there, and they keep pushing them. They don't like the metal, you know, which makes perfect sense. If you've been shackled to a wall with a chunk of metal, you're not going to be very fond of metal. But the mannequins themselves, obviously, I can't imagine these first workers installing these mannequins in here. And it was a theatrical thing. There's like a choreographed nature to it. You know, these mannequins are caught in different positions. I can't imagine being one of the people down there in the darkness, because it's always dark. It's impossible to really light that place up. And it's almost like it absorbs light. But being down there would have been terrifying. And from the very beginning, people said they saw the chains move. They would think that they saw the mannequins move. And I think what's really happening is the mannequins provide cover to the spirits. The spirits are moving in and out and among the mannequins, using them as cover and throwing people off, because it's, oh, well, that was a mannequin. No, that wasn't a mannequin. That was a ghost. You think it's a mannequin because there are mannequins there. And that those mannequins did move and talk at one time, which makes it even creepier. They have plug-ins. They're automatonic. And they have different motions, almost like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean stuff. But they unplugged them about 20 years ago. But I still, every year, I'll have several people walk up to me after a visit to the dungeon and go, "Mr. Johnson, I saw the mannequin move." And I'll politely remind them, and I'll say, you may have. You know, I'm certainly not going to doubt anybody. I didn't see it. I don't know what they saw, what they just saw. See? But I'll tell them, you know, well, the mannequins were unplugged about 20-some-odd years ago. So I doubt it. But, you know, maybe. I think what's more likely is you didn't see the mannequins.
What would you say is the reason for why did they unplug the mannequins 20-some years ago?
I don't know. I think it was just a little over the top.
Okay.
When you grow up on the East Coast as a child, even when you grew up in a state like South Carolina, there was always this pilgrimage that people would take to go down to Florida, because that was where all the tourists went. And, you know, we all have fond memories of driving with my family on 95 or whatever it used to be back then, before the interstate existed, when I was 17. And we would drive down to Florida, and we would go to places like Six Gun Territory. And these were places, you know, where mannequins were laid out, you know, to create exhibits. And they would move. And I think it was just a fashion back then. And so the dungeon authorities thought, well, let's make it more realistic. Let's just create an experience for people. And then finally they realized that maybe that was a little over the top. So they decided to unplug them and make it more, because Charleston always struggles with that. Charleston likes to pride itself on being above all that.
Okay.
And of course, we all know they're not. But they think they are, and so sometimes they'll do things like that just to kind of set themselves apart. We don't do that. you know. So at some point, somebody decided it was not savory to be, you know, have moving parts in the dungeon, so they just unplugged them.
It's such a creepy concept. Just these formerly animatronic mannequins that are in this dungeon setting that are unplugged.
It's the precursor to a horror movie.
It really is.
Suddenly they come alive.
I'm just curious, and this is not ghost related, but have you ever plugged one back in just to see if it still works?
No, I doubt they work now. I would doubt very seriously they did work, but I'd love to. That's a really good question. I hadn't thought of that. I know some of the people who manage the dungeon. I'll ask them if they've ever tried it.
I'd be curious.
I doubt they have, because most people who work in the exchange building are these folks who have the distinction in Charleston. First of all, they're excellent guides. They're all very highly trained. They don't call them guides in the dungeon. They call them ghosts. And they are expected to wear period clothing. And that might be another reason why they decide to phase it out. Maybe there's a little confusion between the animatronic mannequins and the actual staff who are walking around wearing the same kind of clothes. But the docents, the guides in there, will tell you that they don't like going down in the dungeon.
Yeah.
They don't like being in the building after dark. But they definitely don't like going down in the dungeon any time of day, and especially at night. Because what happens in the dungeon is that, again, it's dark, it's oppressive. The walls are kind of pressing down on you, and you see this crude brick floor down below, which you know was used to hold prisoners, and people would have spilled their blood and their guts down there. There's this DNA all crawling around underneath the seat, and you're thinking, oh my God, I don't know, this place doesn't feel right, and you start hearing things.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Randy Johnson about the Charleston Dungeon. In part two of our interview, available to grave keepers only, we'll discuss what kind of medieval torture techniques took place in the dungeon. Why do many of the ghosts seem to be of the pirate era? Also, who are some of the specific spirits that haunt the Charleston Dungeon? And how have they communicated to let us know their identity? Are the spirits aware that time has moved past their own lifetimes? And what is Steve Bonnet's ghost doing today at the dungeon? Until next time for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.